Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 57. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Welcome to the show. This week we bring you The Shadow on the Doorstep by James Blaylock, narrated by Fred Heimbaugh. As regular listeners will know, James Paul Blaylock is an American fantasy author known for his contributions to the steampunk genre. Along with Tim Powers and K.W. Jetta, he was mentored by Philip K. Dick, and along with Powers, invented the recurring poet character William Ashbless. Born September 20th, 1950, his output thus far includes the Bulumnia, Narbonda, Christian, and Ghosts trilogies, and also many short stories. He is currently director of the Creative Writing Conservatory at the Orange County High School of the Arts, where Powers is writer-in-residence. For irregular listeners, here's a tip. Episode 29 of PPP includes another story by Blaylock called The Pink of Fading Neon, and also an interview with the author. As for our narrator, you might remember from a few episodes ago that Fred Heimbaugh contributes to the District of Wonders in a number of ways, as the assistant editor of Protecting Project Pulp, but also as an author, reviewer, narrator, and song producer. Outside the district, you can find his latest song, Abraham Lincoln Was an Invader from Space, on YouTube, iTunes, and Amazon, and his science fiction story, Fingers, will appear in issue number 20 of Fusion Fragment. His life includes a wife, two children, and a series of highly improbable pulp fiction-inspired elements such as corpses in the basement, aliens on the back lawn, and a cat that speaks Latin, which he describes on Facebook, Google+, and on Twitter under the handle Fredosphere. So look carefully. Are those scales barely visible within? The Shadow on the Doorstep by James Blaylock, narrated by Fred Heimbaugh.
It was several months after I had dismantled my aquaria that I heard a rustling in the darkness, a scraping of what sounded like footsteps on the front porch of my house. It startled me out of a literary lethargy built partly of 3 hours of Jules Verne, partly of a nodding acquaintance with a bottle of single malt scotch. In the yellow glow of the porch lamp, through the tiny distorting panes of the mullioned upper half of the oaken door, I saw only a shadow, a face perhaps, half turned away. The dark outline of it was lost in the shaded confusion of an unpruned hibiscus. The porch itself was a rectangular island of hooded light, cut with drooping shadows of potted plants, and the rectilinear darkness of a pair of weather-stained mission chairs. Encircling it was a tumult of shrubbery. Beyond lay the street and the feeble glow of globed lamps, all of it washed in pale moonlight that served only to darken that wall of shrubbery, so that the porch with its yellow bug light and foliage seemed a self-contained world of dwindling enchantment. I couldn't say with any confidence, as I sat staring in sullen, unexplained horror at the start this late visitor had given me, that the leafy appendages thrusting away on either side of him weren't arms, or some strange melange of limbs and fins. With the weak light at his back, he was a fishy shadow suffused in the amber aura of porch light, something which had crawled dripping out of a late Devonian sea. In the interests of objectivity, I'll say again that I had been reading Jules Verne, and it's altogether reasonable that a mixture of the book, the shadows, the embers aglow in the fireplace, the late hour, and a morbid suspicion that nothing but trouble travels in the suburbs after dark combined to enchant into existence this troublesome shade that was nothing, in fact, but the scraping of a branch of hibiscus against the window pane. But you can understand that I wasn't anxious to open the door. I put the book down silently, the afterimage of the interior of the Nautilus slanting across my consciousness and then submerging, and I remember wondering at the appropriateness of the scene in the novel, the crystal panels bound in copper, beyond which floated transparent sheets of water illuminated by sunlight, the lazy undulations of eels and fishes, of lampreys and Japanese salamanders and blue and silver clouds of schooling mackerel. Slipping into the shadows beyond the couch, I pressed myself against the wall and crept into the darkened study where a window would afford me a view of most of the porch. My aquaria, as I've said, were dismantled some months earlier, 6, I believe. The water siphoned out a window and into a flower bed. The water weeds collapsed in a soggy heap. The fish, astonished to find themselves imprisoned in a 3-gallon bucket. These last I gave to a nearby tropical fish store. The empty aquaria, with its gravel and lumps of petrified stone, I stored beneath a bench in the shed under my avocado tree. It was a sad undertaking, all in all, like bundling up pieces of my boyhood and packing them away in a crate. I sometimes have the notion that opening the crate would restore them wholesale, that the recreation of years gone by could be effected by dragging in a hose and filling the tanks with clear water, by banking the gravel around rocks heaped to form dark caverns, the entrances of which are shadowed by the reaching tendrils of water weeds through which glow watery rays of reflected light. But the visitor on the porch that night dissuaded me. 3 aquarium shops sit neatly in my memory by day and are confused and shuffled by night, giddily trading fishes and facades, all of them alive with the hum and bubble of pumps and filters and the damp, musty smell of fish tank drip-dripping tropical water onto concrete floors. 1 I discovered by bicycle when I was 13. It was a clapboard house on a frontage road along a freeway, the exhaust of countless roaring trucks and automobiles, having dusted the peeling white paint with black grime. Inside sat dozens of 10-gallon tanks, poorly lit, the water within them half evaporated. There wasn't much to recommend it, even to a 13-year-old, aside from a door in the back, what used to be a kitchen door, I suppose, that led along a gravel path to what had been a garage. These 30 years later, I can recall the very day I discovered it. The gravel path, that is, easily a year after my first bicycle journey to the shop. I'd wandered around inside, shaking my head at the condition of the aquaria, despising the guppies and the goldfish and tetras that swam sluggishly past their scattered dead companions. My father waited in a Studebaker at the curb outside, drumming his fingers along the top of the passenger seat. A sign in pencil scrawl attracted my eye, advertising another room of fish outside. And so out I stepped along that gravel path, shoving into the darkened back half of the garage, which was unlit save for the incandescent bulbs in aquarium reflectors. I shut the door behind me for no other reason than to keep out sunlight. Banks of aquaria lined 3 walls, all of them a deep greenish black, the water within lit against a backdrop of Elodea and Amazon sword plant and the waving, lacy branches of Ambulia and Sagittarius. There was the faint bursting of fine bubbles that danced toward the surface from aerators trapped beneath mossy stones. On the sandy floor of one aquarium lay a half dozen mottled freshwater rays from the Amazon, their poisonous tails almost indistinguishable from the gravel they rested on. A half score of buffalo head chichlids hovered in the shelter of an arched heap of waterfall rock, under which was coiled the long, finny serpent's tail of a reedfish. The aquarium seemed to me to be prodigiously deep, a trick, perhaps, of reflection and light and the clever arrangement of rocks and water plants. But it suggested, just for a moment, that the shadowed water within was somehow as vast as the sea bottom, or was a sort of antechamber to the driftwood and pebble floor of a tropical river. Other aquaria flanked it. Gobies peered up at me from out of burrows in the sand. An enormous compressiceps, flat as a plate, blinked out from behind a tangle of cryptocorn grasses. Leaffish floated amid the lacy brown of decaying vegetation, and a hovering pair of golf-ball-sized puffers, red eyes blinking, tiny pectoral fins whirring like submarine propellers, peered suspiciously from beneath a ledge of dark stone. There was something utterly alien about that room full of fishes, existing in manufactured amber light, 1,000 miles removed from the dusty gravel of the yard outside, from the roaring freeway traffic not 60 feet distant. I stood staring, oblivious to the time, until the door swung open in a flood of sunlight and my father peeked in. In the sudden illumination, the odd atmosphere of the room seemed to decay, to disperse, and it reminds me now of what must happen to a forest glade when the sun rises and dispels the damp enchanted pall summoned each night by moonlight from the roots and mulch and earth of the forest floor. One dimmed tank was lit briefly by the sunlight, and in it, crouched behind a tumble of dark stone, was an almost hidden creature with an enormous head and eyes. The eyes of a squid or a spaniel, eyes that were lidded, that blinked slowly and sadly past the curious scattered decorations of its tank, a half dozen agate marbles, a platoon of painted lead soldiers, a brass sheriff's star, and a little tin shovel angling from a bucket half full of tilted sand and painted in tints of azure and yellow, a scene of children playing along a sunset beach. I was old enough and imaginative enough to be struck by the incongruity of the contents of that aquarium. I wasn't, though, well enough schooled in ichthyology to remark on the lidded eyes of the creature in the tank, which is just as well. I was given over to nightmares as it was. A year passed before I had occasion to visit the shop beside the freeway again, and I can recall bicycling along wet streets through intermittent showers, hunched over a yellow hooded slicker, my pant legs soaked from the knees down, rewarded finally with the sight of no shop at all, but of a vacant lot already up in weeds, the concrete foundation of the clapboard house and garage brown with rainwater and mud. Here it was nearly midnight, 30 years later, and something was stirring on my front porch. Wind out of the west shuffled the foliage, and I could hear the sighing of fronds in the queen palms along the curb. I stood in shadow, wafered against a tilted bookcase, peering past the edge of the casement at nothing. There was a rustling of bushes and swaying shadow. Something, what was it, was skulking out there. I was certain. Hairs prickled along the back of my neck. A low, mournful boom of distant thunder followed a wintry clatter of raindrops. The wet, ozone smell of the rain on concrete washed through the room, and I realized, with a start, that a window had blown open behind me. I turned and pushed it shut, crouching below the sill so as not to be seen, thinking, without meaning to, of wandering in the rain across the ruins of the tropical fish stop, searching in the weeds for nothing I could name, and finding only shards of broken glass and a ceramic fishbowl castle the color of an Easter egg. I slipped tight the bolt on the window and crept across my bookcase, peering once again out into the seemingly empty night, where the branches of hibiscus with their drooping pink flowers danced in the wind and rain. In San Francisco, in Chinatown, in an alley off Washington, lies the second of the three aquarium shops. I was a student at the time. I'd eaten a remarkable dinner at a restaurant called Sam Wu and was wandering along the foggy evening street looking for a set of those compressed origami flowers that bloom when dropped into water, when I saw a sign depicting Chinese ideographs and a lacy-looking tri-colored koi. I slouched down a narrow alley between canted buildings, the misty air smelling of garlic and fog, barbecued duck, and spilled garbage. Through a slender doorway veiled with the smell of musty sand sounded the familiar hum of aquaria. The shop itself was vast and dark beneath low ceilings. Dim rooms, lost in shadow, stretched away beneath the street, scattered aquarium lights glowing like misty distant stars. Flat breeding tanks were stacked five deep on rusted steel stands below a row of darkened transom windows that fronted the alley. Exotic goldfish labored to stay afloat, staring through bubble eyes, their caudal fins so enormously overgrown that they seemed to drag the creatures backward. One of the fish, I remember, was the size and shape of a grapefruit, a stupendous freak, bred for the sake of nothing more than curiosity. Illogically, perhaps because of my having stumbled years earlier upon that shed full of odd fish along the freeway, it occurred to me that the most distant rooms would contain even more curious fish. So I hesitantly wandered deeper, under Washington, I suppose, only to discover that yet farther rooms existed. That room seemed to open onto others through arched doors, the ancient plaster of which was so discolored and mossy from the constant humidity that it appeared as if the openings were chipped out of stone. Vast aquaria full of trailing water weeds sat bank upon bank, and in them swam creatures that had, weeks earlier, lurked in driftwood grottos in the Amazon and Orinoco. There was something about the place that brought to mind the shovel and bucket, the promise of pending mystery, perhaps horror. Each aquarium, with its shadowy corners and heap stone and lacy plants, seemed a tiny enclosed world, as did the shop itself, utterly adrift from the noisy Chinatown alleyways and streets above, which crisscrossed in a foggy tapestry of a world alien to the hilly sprawl of San Francisco, each successive layer full of wonder and threat. There was something in my reaction to it akin to the attraction Professor Aronnax felt to the interior of the Nautilus with its library of black, violet, ebony, and brass, its 12,000 books, its luminous ceilings and pipe organ and jars of mollusks and sea stars and black pearls larger than pigeons' eggs, and its glass walls through which, as if from within an aquarium, one had a night and day view of the depths of the sea. I was confronted on the edge of the second chamber by a tiny oriental man, his face lost in shadow. I hadn't heard him approach. He held in his hand a dripping net large enough to snare a sea bass, and he wore rubber boots as if he were in the habit of clambering into aquaria to pursue fish. His sudden appearance startled me out of a peculiar frame of mind that accounted for, I'm certain, the curious idea that in the faint pearl-like luminosity of aquarium light, the arm and hand that held the net were scaled. I found my way to the street. He hadn't said anything, but the slow shaking of his head had seemed to indicate that I wasn't entirely welcome there, that it was a hatchery, perhaps, a wholesale house in which casual strollers would find nothing that would interest them. And it was nothing, years later, that I found on the front porch. The wind blew rain under the eaves and against the panes of the window. Water ran along them in rivulets, distorting even further the waving foliage on the porch, making it impossible to determine whether the dark places were mere shadow or were more than that. I returned to my couch and book and fireplace, piling split cedar logs atop burned-down fragments, and blowing on the embers until the wood popped and crackled and firelight danced on the walls of the living room. It must have been 2 o'clock in the morning by then, a morbid hour, it seems to me, but somehow I was disinclined toward bed, and so I sat browsing in my book, idly sipping at my glass, and half listening to the shuffle and scrape of things in the night, and the occasional rumble of faraway thunder. I couldn't, somehow, keep my eyes off the door, although I pretended to continue to read. The result was that I focused on nothing at all, but must have fallen asleep, for I lurched awake in the sound of a clay flower pot crashing to bits on the porch outside, the victim, possibly, of a rainy gust of wind. I sat up, tumbling Jules Verne to the rug, a half-formed dream of tilted pier pilings and dark stone pools of placid water dissolving into mist in my mind. A shadow loomed beyond the door. I snatched at the little pole chain of the wall sconce overhead and pitched the room into darkness, thinking to hide my own movements as well as to illuminate those of the thing on the porch. But almost as soon as the light evaporated, leaving only the orange glow of the settled fire, I switched the light back on. It was futile to think of hiding myself, and as for whatever it was that lurked on the threshold, I hadn't any monumental desire to confront it. So I sat trembling. The shadow remained, as if it watched and listened, satisfied to know that I knew it was there. There had been another tropical fish store in San Pedro, in a dockside street of thrift stores and bars and boarded-up windows. The harbor side of the street was built largely upon pilings, and below the slumping wooden buildings were shadowy broken remnants of abandoned wharfs and the shifting gray Pacific tide. The windows of the shop were obscured by heavy dust that had lain on the cracked panes for years, and there were only dim, scattered lights shining beyond to indicate that the building wasn't deserted. A painted sign on the door read, "Tropical Rarities, Fish and Amphibia," and below it, taped to the inside of the door and barely visible through the dust, was a yellowed price list advertising, I recall, Colombian horned frogs and tiger salamanders at prices 20 years out of date. The door was locked. From within, I was certain of it, came the humming of aquaria and the swish-splash of aerated water against a background of murmured voices. Had I been 10 years younger, I would have rapped on the glass, perhaps shouted. But my interest in aquaria had waned, and I had come to the neighborhood, actually, to purchase tickets for a boat ride to Catalina Island. So I turned to leave, only vaguely curious, noting for the first time a wooden stairway, angling steeply away toward the docks, its style grate left carelessly ajar. I hesitated before it, peering down along the warped banister, and saw hanging from the wooden siding of the building a simple wordless sign depicting ideographs, and a tri-colored koi. It was the shock of curious recognition, as much as anything, that impelled me down those stairs, grinning foolishly, rehearsing what it was I'd say to whomever I'd meet at the bottom. But I met no one, only the lapping of dark water against the stones, and a scattering of red crabs that scuttled away into the shadows of mossy rock. Overhanging buildings formed a sort of open-air cellar, dark and cool and smelling of mussels and barnacles and mudflats. At first, the darkness within was impenetrable, but as I shaded my eyes and stepped into the shadows, I made out a half-dozen dim rings of mottled stone, amphibian pools, I imagined, their sides draped with trailing water plants. "Hello," I called out timorously, I suppose, and was met with silence, except for a brief splashing in one of the pools. I stepped forward hesitantly. I had no business being there, but I was struck with the idea that I must see what it was that dwelt within those circular pools. The first appeared to be empty of life, aside from great tendrils of tangled elodea and a floating carpet of broadleaf duckweed. I knelt on the wet stone and swept the duckweed aside with my hands, squinting into the depths. Some few bits of clouded daylight filtered in from above, but the feeble illumination was hardly enough to lighten the pool. Something, though, glistened for a moment below, as if beckoning, signifying, and I found myself glancing around me guiltily, even as I rolled up my shirt sleeve. "In for a penny," I thought to myself, plunging my arm in up to the shoulder. There was a movement then beneath the water, as if the pool were deeper than I'd thought, and I'd disturbed the solitude of some submerged creature. I groped among the plants and gravel, nearly dipping my ear into the water. There it was, lying on its side. My fingers closed over the half-loop of its handle, just as a slow scuffling sounded from the far end of the twilit room. I stood up, prepared for heaven knew what, holding in my hand, impossibly, a familiar tin pail, its side dented in now, its blue ocean bent over and half-submerging the children still at play, these many years later, along its sandy beach. Before me crouched a small Oriental man, staring oddly, as if he half recognized my face, and amazed to find me, it seemed, in the act of purloining that bent toy pail. I dropped it into the pool, began to speak, then turned and hurried away. The man who had confronted me wore no rubber boots, and he carried no enormous fishnet in his hand. In the dim half-light of that strange ocean-side grotto, his skin, at a hasty glance, was nothing more than skin. I could insist, for the sake of cheap adventure, that he was scaled, gilled perhaps, with webbed hands and an ear-to-ear mouth. And he easily might have been. I left without a backward glance, focusing on the alligatored blue paint of the ramshackle stairway, on the shingled roof that rose into view on the opposite side of the street as I climbed, step by creaking step. I drove home, I recall, punching randomly on the buttons of my car radio, turning it on and off, aware of the incongruity, the superfluousness of the music and the newscasts and the foolish and alien radio chatter. The incident rather took the wind out of the sails of my tropical fish collecting, sails that were half-furled anyway, and certain odd, otherwise innocent pictures began to haunt my dreams. Random images of pale angular faces, of painted lead soldiers scattered in a weedy lot, of the furtive movement of fish in weed-shadowed aquaria, of a wooden signboard swinging and swinging in the wind-driven rain. Beyond the locked front door lies nothing more than the shadow of evening foliage stirring in the rainy wind. Common sense would have it so, would say, in a smug and tiresome voice, that I've been confused by a dangerous combination of coincidence and happenstance. It would be an invitation to madness not to heed such a voice. But it's not a night for heeding voices. The wind and rain lash at the dark shrubbery. The shadows waver and dance. Through the window glass, nothing at all can be seen beyond the pallid light of the porch lamp. 2 hours from now, the sun will rise, and with it will come a manufactured disregard for the suggestion of connections, of odd patterns behind the seemingly random. The front porch, rainwater drying in patches, the mission chair sitting solid and substantial, the oranges and pinks of hibiscus bloom grinning at the day, will be inhabited only by a hurrying, square-jawed milkman in a white cap and by the solid clink of bottles in a galvanized metal basket.
That was The Shadow on the Doorstep by James Blaylock, narrated by Fred Heimbaugh. So many of the stories we run go straight for the throat, as it were, piling up outlandish events and settings at a breakneck pace, in a mad rush to the climactic conclusion. While that's a common part of the pulp tradition, it's refreshing sometimes to have an author patiently construct a narrative and an atmosphere of quiet and alien menace. And if you like this story, don't forget that we have another Blaylock tale in the archive, The Pink of Fading Neon, back in episode 29, and also narrated by Fred. So, new authors versus returning authors. To cast your vote, drop by the site at protectingprojectpulp.com and leave a comment on the episode post, or join the conversation in the District of Wonders forum, linked from the site. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click on the subscribe link. Remember, there's plenty more mysterious, scaly menace to be brought to narrated life. So drop us an email at protectingprojectpulp@gmail.com for your chance to give something back to the District of Wonders. Thanks for listening. From everyone here at PPP, our narrator / assistant editor, Fred Heimbaugh, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Remember also that August is shore leave time here at the District of Wonders. PPP will be taking a 2-week break, and we'll be back in September with episode 58, where we'll bring you Strange Eden by Philip K. Dick. Remember that we all feel like a fish out of water at some stage, and have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.